would you introduce yourself, please?
Sure. I'm Craig Finn from the Hold Steady.
Amazing. I like revisionist history. So we can fill in all the dumb blanks. And they're not dumb blanks, but they're blanks. Okay, let's see. It's officially more than 10 years, but you've done 10-year shows, blah, blah, blah. You formed because you had nothing better to do, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I hope this isn't too mundane, but I've, you know, in the past 10 years, or at the 10-year or 11-year anniversary, I've been thinking a lot about the beginning of the band. I almost think that some way the Hold Steady was informed by, like, dollar and $2 records in that...
Ah, the cutout bin.
Yeah. I mean, I was really into punk rock and hardcore, and I was kind of had Led Zeppelin and things like that at an arm's length until I was in my 20s, and then I'd start to go to the record store and kind of was discovering classic rock through the you know, used records, $2. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of, you know, there's a lot of Stones records out there in bad shape, most of them, but a lot of them...
That's the way you should listen to them.
Yeah, they're crackly, you know? And so, yeah, just going out and getting three or four things that I knew I should have listened to, maybe. You know, I was probably in my 20s before I really knew Sticky Fingers or something like that. So... kind of coming through punk rock and being more open-minded to classic rock, I think, is where, you know, kind of the beginning of the Hold Steady to do something that I thought was more classic or more straight down the middle.
It's true. And I probably was even in my 30s, and I think still I'll go through the used record bins and go, wait a minute, you know, that I really never listened to that album, and I don't know that much about it. And it happens with big artists, which is the strangest thing. Not even the, I'm going to go crate digging and go for the obscure stuff, but there's big bands that I realize I have this big cavern in my whole, you know, and as people who are in the music industry, you wouldn't think that would be the case, right?
Yeah. I mean, for me, like, even, you know, I'm 42 and I'm still kind of wrapping my head around the Kinks. Like, it was something I got into like 6-7 years ago, but there's so much of it and you can kind of take a little bit at a time. And that's something, you know, as a huge music fan, music's my main thing. That got until I was 35 before I really got into it, you know?
4 years to make an album. Oh my gosh. That is forever in today's internet age. But the thing that people forget, or maybe they don't even think about, is okay, There's a couple of ways to make a record. You can make it in your living room and you can just put it together in Pro Tools and you can do it. You can track it in a week and you can put it together. Or you can spend 2 years making a record, make a solo album somewhere in the middle of that, and then take a deep breath and say, okay, we've been a band for a while. Who do we want to be, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and you know, it's 4 years between albums, but when you look at it as 10 years, it's 6 records in 10 years, which is pretty quick. We put a lot of those in the first six. We did, you know, 5 records in 6 or 7 years. And as a result of that, we were pretty fatigued and we toured hard on everything and we needed a little break. And the break, you know, turned into, you know, I did the solo record and then it took us a while to get kind of the momentum going. I always said, you know, people asked us why we were moving so quick before. And I said, it's almost like, if your daughter or son announced he was taking a semester off from college, you'd say, well, then you're not going back, you know?
You're not. Wait a minute. You're not a rock band.
Yeah, so I always said, you know, it's best to keep this momentum going. But we needed the break, and then it took us a little bit to get going again on this. One of the reasons was Steve Selvidge joined on the last record for the touring. This record he is writing and recording with us. He lives in Memphis. So it was getting kind of over that geographic, like we'd fly him to New York, but it felt really formal or forced sometimes, like, all right, ready, write. And so we had to kind of push through that. And that said, we probably could have made the record quicker. I think once we met the producer, Nick Raskolnitz, he was like, guys, you're absolutely ready to make a record. You know, let's do it.
This is, as posed, the big rock record. Now, if you're going to have a producer for a big rock record, a guy who's involved with the Foos and Rush and Alice in Chains, if you're going to make a big rock record, this might be the guy. But it's even more interesting that you're telling me that you had a chat with him and he told you you were ready to make a record.
Yeah, well, he heard all the songs and we had a lot of them. And, you know, he was like, we had more than enough. And he was kind of like, you've got it in here. We just got to put a little work in the songs and let's go make this record. And absolutely, yeah, he was a great big rock producer. We saw him on the Sound City movie that Dave Grohl did. And Nick came off really well and sympathetic in that movie, empathetic. and you know, a big rock guy with a big heart, kind of. And we liked him from that movie. That's why we got in touch.
What Big Rock Record really means in many ways, aside from the producer, and we'll get into some of the songs, but to me it also means that you have Steve, right? You keyboards kind of exited, and second guitar, so now you have this two guitar attack thing going. And that's got to be kind of, after all these other records, it's got to be freeing to do something completely where you can just kick ass rock and roll.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm 42 years old, and if you're 42 and making your sixth record, I think everyone's looking for the mandolins. You know, everyone's expecting you to bring in something really mellow. And so to have Steve in the band, and he's been playing with us a while live, so we really do have a good dynamic with him. And for him to kind of write and be able to take advantage of the two guitar things was absolutely, I think, the most important thing about this record and defining in the sound. And it's really cool to watch Steve and Tad play together. I mean, they were actually born on the same day. So there's this like real kind of simpatico thing that happens. And the push and pull between them is just, I think, you know, the big defining part of our sound right now.
So one of the things you've said is that, and I'm going to give you two quotes at once. One is that there are higher highs and lower lows, which I really like. But my favorite quote is, it's more dramatic, people getting shot and falling off the roof or something. But when you really think, in my mind, back to those $2 bins, the songs that we love are true narratives. And the thing about your songs have always been that they're stories. True or not is not even relevant. We're not even going to go down that road. That road's been well paved. Oh, was it about me or are you making up stuff? But when you talk about people getting shot or falling off the roof, well, I don't think either has happened to you. But the rock and roll, the real rock idiom is really the opportunity. The boys are back in town. Yes. Not comparing to a band. But when you listen to that song, every time you hear it, there's a movie that goes on in your head.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's stuff like Jungle Land or anything off Born to Run, Thunder Road, are these absolute cinematic moments in rock and roll. And I was always really attracted to those songs, you know. So when I went to write my own songs, I wanted to write songs like that, that had big stories, arcs, Tangled Up in Blue, things happening in a way that you could picture. And I think that it's interesting, I've said this before, that people who make movies aren't held to this idea that it's all confessional. But songwriters, somehow a lot of people think, if you write it, that had to have happened to you. And you know, I always say, no one says Quentin Tarantino like shoots people's heads off and does karate. So I wanted, with the Hold Steady, especially, the music's so big, I wanted to create something that was cinematic to go along with it. And, you know, people getting shot and falling off roofs, which hasn't happened to me, but if I wrote, you know, to these big guitars and these thundering drums, if I wrote about going to the store and going to the post office, you know, the things I'm doing most days, it wouldn't be that hot.
You're on tour, you're in a place, and sometimes you're not in the greatest place in the world. Sometimes you're in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and not, no offense, but you're in these places that are kind of downtrodden. And these kind of cities are not cities. You walk around the hoods and you kind of see the houses and you kind of think, boy, there's a lot of stories right there, aren't there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do love the travel of touring, and but I have a hard time sitting in one place or sitting in a hotel room. Sometimes if you're lucky, you're walking through a city or even a lesser city. Sometimes you're walking along a frontage road on the side of a highway if you're really restless. So, but I get a lot of inspiration that either just the signs or, like you said, looking at houses or just kind of keep moving and just feel like displacing yourself a little bit allows you to see things a little differently than the places you actually live.
Years ago, it's 10 years ago, building a fan base was a different game. You didn't just go out on site of choice and build a fan base. But you have a fan base that stayed with you, so when you come back, you didn't have to come back.
Right. Well, they've been there all along. And I think our relationship with our fans is somewhat due to us and somewhat a lot due to them, mostly due to them. There's a community that exists around the band. And I think that's more and more important. You know, we are able to go on Twitter. We are able to go on Facebook and disseminate information or quote unquote connect with other people. But I think rock and roll more and more is going to be about putting people in a room with shared interests and having this shared experience physically. In the same place, and uh, I I think that that's what we've been able to do. We've been able to do things, you know, get to a place together with our fans that's exciting. And I think our fans feel a part of it. And I think, you know, you talk about revisionist history. I don't think it's revisionist history. I think it was very true that when we started the Hold Steady, we wanted to create something that was inclusive, that people felt a part of. And, you know, I talked about being a classic rock band, but also punk and hardcore. When I was into punk and hardcore, there was a scene that I felt a part of. You know, it was something, at the best moments anyways, inclusive. You went to the show, no matter if you liked the band, you just needed to be around those people, your friends. And I wanted to create something, or we wanted to create something, around the just more straight-ahead rock music that felt like that.
But it's a modern world, and one of the things you've done is you've got your own imprint now. And so here's Razor and Tie, who's a label that has remade itself multiple times, and obviously but behind them, good distribution, good support, you know, a good team, and then that's an opportunity for you to turn around and say, good, we want our own imprint, and we want all the goods that go with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think for us it was just a brand, you know, like kind of to have that. I mean, we have plans. We did the covers EP. And we have the record. We thought, well, maybe if we're going to start, I mean, it seems like there's an opportunity at some level now to release your own music, you know, maybe off cycle or whether it be a covers EP like we did. And we wanted to do something that just kind of appeared on all our releases. So that's why we started the imprint. And, you know, it kind of carves out a space that we might be able to do things in the future.
Let's talk about Jersey Mike and the covers EP, because it's more about the emotional tug and the reasoning behind it.
Yeah, it's twofold. I mean, like I said, we have great fans, and some of the most dedicated have this group called the Unified Scene. It was kind of an unofficial fan club, and they had T-shirts they'd wear to the shows to, you know, identify, help them identify each other, because they mainly talked to each other on the message board, and they wouldn't always know what they looked like. So if you wore your shirt, they could get in touch. And Jersey Mike was the unofficial leader of it, and he even kind of crossed over from before. He was a fan, then he became a friend, but then he also kind of helped us with running the message board and some of the website stuff. So he was really involved. He died suddenly at 36 years old in November 2012, has two kids that he left behind. And we thought, you know, the standard rock reaction to any tragedy is some hastily assembled benefit show. And we said, let's not do that. Let's figure out what we want to do. And so, you know, with this record coming out, we thought maybe let's take the Unified Scene and make it official. Let's release this covers EP. In order to get in the Unified Scene, you got to get the covers EP. You got to pledge for it. And, you know, a portion of the proceeds go to Foundation for Mike's Children. So it was a way to kind of twofold raise money, but also kind of figure out where everyone is, how to get a hold of them, and make this thing kind of bring it, make it official. And there was also, we did it through Pledge Music, and there was also add-on things like people could get their hair cut by Tad. They could go they could go jogging with me, things like
that.
And the response was amazing. We hit our goal in 24 hours.
It's insane.
Of a 30-day campaign. So, you know, it was pretty successful. We've had a lot of fun doing that. And it's really. But I think it just solidifies the relationship with the fans and who they are.
So I'm listening to the record late last night, and I'm just going. I'm like, okay, well, it's 1:30 in the morning, and now I've got a 9-minute and 2-second song to listen to with the shortest title ever.
Our longest song with our shortest title.
Yeah, but that's pretty cool because, again, if you're making a rock record, and back to the, we'll just keep the circle unbroken here. When you get down to those records that we talked about, and everybody jokes about, you know, Freebird or Stairway to Heaven, and, you know, screams them out of shows. But you know what? These anthems, these long things, in the end become some of the most captivating things to people, because as much as they joke about them, they're the ones that people pay attention to.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, and it has to be the last statement. It's kind of a grand statement. It has to be the last song. But that song also was shorter. It's the song Oaks, the last song on a record. And it was so down that I kind of came and said, like, why don't we do attach some sort of coda or scene change or something to end it on a little more hopeful note. And so we kind of tacked on the ending there, and we really loved it. I mean, I think, like, that's one that we were really excited about in the studio and still are. But it was able to end the whole thing on a, I think, a bit more hopeful note.
You know, it's funny because when I read about what Teeth Dreams is about, and then I thought, I've never had a teeth dream, but then I realized that after listening to this record, I might have more teeth dreams.
Someone was saying that they, someone I know was saying that they had an argument with someone about whether it was a good title or not for a record, and then when they went home that night, they had a teeth dream. So I, for those people,
you're gonna help, you know, dentists, because people, grit, you know, you're gonna be all these misaligned teeth. You're gonna help the dental industry in a big way here.
I'm trying to help.
This is a sink. There's a sink for Crest coming up here.
I'm trying to help someone. But yeah, I mean, I think most people, a lot of people have had teeth dreams because I've had people ever, oh, so many people, once we announced the record, they're like, oh, I have those. And then it sounds like I'm inducing some too. So it's a very unifying thing. If for those people who haven't had them, they're about to have them.
So when people, and again, we don't talk about this, but when people talk about this band, the first thing they say is, wait a minute, they don't look like a rock band, right? And yet, in the end, one of the things that you said a lot of the songs are about, they're, you know, about that money, personal appearance, all of this. In the old days, until you went on the Ed Sullivan Show, until you went on American Bandstand, until you really had a personification of a band, people just had the music. We now live in an age where there is so much personification and so much is on look and feel. And not only pop music, but rock and roll too. So when you think about all of that, and now you think about this new record, you think, wait a minute, in the end, looking back, none of that really matters, right?
Well, yeah, maybe. I mean, I think like one of the things that's interesting to me is just to be super honest, you know, like that was kind of the idea with the Hold Steady, besides the fact that some of these things don't happen to me in the songs, but having an honest approach and saying like, you know, I'm 42 years old, this is what we look like, etc. There's a power in that, saying, you know, if I'm honest with you, you can't take it away from me. And I think that there, in some ways, that's like a way to diffuse that sort of the modern obsession with that.
I've invented a thing called a musical sandwich. And what it is two of your songs is the bread, and then songs by anybody else in between. And what I do is I play 40 minutes of solid music with no jingles, no anything.